This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're talking with Norm Hubbard, who is the campus director, the national staff advisor of the local student chapter of The Navigators. Welcome, Norm.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be here.
Now, tell us what The Navigators is.
The Navigators is a Christian student organization, a registered student organization here at the University of Illinois, and it's a non-denominational Christian outreach that is a ministry, helps students to study and understand the scriptures, apply them to their lives, and reach out to others. It's part of a national and really a multinational organization.
And by talking about the scriptures, you're talking about the Christian Bible, the Jewish,
the Hebrew
the scriptures,
and the
New scriptures. Testament. Okay.
Yeah.
The Christians often call the Old Testament and the New Testament. We'll get back to those kind of categories in a minute, but let me remind listeners that this month is National Poetry Month, and thanks to the Poetry Foundation, we were able to have readings from Poetry Magazine earlier this month. Today, I don't have permission from any particular publisher, so I'm limited to reading one of my poems, but I do have one called The Bible, which seemed appropriate since we're talking about a student group that focuses on understanding the Christian Bible. This was published in the Anglican Theological Review, and I wrote this a couple decades ago, but I still like it. So it's called The Bible. About 100 words this is, the poem, that is. The Bible's longer. That library, the library that Jews, Muslims, and Christians read and memorize is greater than them all. The wind that blows from ancient desert still can part the seas and lead us out to arid, wandering thirst. Mere answers are not there, only the faith of Abraham and Sarah's laugh, the lost battles, the broken laws, sickness and death, redeemed by hope of hope. The God we meet, of cult, of nature, strong, one, merciful, demands we worship, love, and share, and wait. Our world is changed, and we are changed, and all our human acts are written in the book of life, the scriptures, the good book. A poem called The Bible that I wrote, published in the Anglican Theological Review some years ago and read by permission of the author. So continuing our celebration of National Poetry Month, the month of April, again this year. Well, back to our guest, Norman Hubbard. Do you have a favorite translation of the Bible into English since it was originally written in two or three other languages?
I do, but Steve, I have to say it's a shame we have to now hear the conversation from me instead of more of your poetry. That was wonderful.
Yeah, thank you.
I have used for many years the New American Standard Bible, the NASB as it's known, oftentimes criticized for its sort of wooden literalism in its translation from the Hebrew and Aramaic and Greek into English. But I'm a word person, and I found that anytime I would read from another more dynamic translation that took greater liberty with the underlying language that was being translated, I would oftentimes, in my own study or devotions, focus on a phrase that would be very meaningful to me, only later to realize that the phrase was one of those ones that came as a byproduct of the liberty that the translators took. So I like a more literal translation and use the NASB.
So that's the New American Standard Bible.
That's right.
There are hundreds, thousands of translations just into English.
Yes.
It's just hard to even keep up. There's so many.
Right. There are. Although, thankfully, you know, for normal people like me, when you walk into a bookstore, there are generally only about 10 of them.
Uh-huh.
For academics, there are thousands. For folks like us, I guess, there are generally just a few that seem to be more prominent.
Now, are there any that you really don't like for any particular reason?
You can't ask me that on the air. No, you can, actually. The ironic thing is that probably the translation that I have the hardest time with is one that is published by my own organization.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the Navigators have a publishing wing called Nav Press, most notable for Bible study materials.
Sure.
But they have published a version of the Bible, a more dynamic, modern rendering of the Bible into English called The Message. It's a work done by a great scholar, Eugene Peterson, who is out of, I believe he's in Vancouver, maybe in Canada. It's a wonderful work, but I utilize it almost more as an interpretive translation of the Bible, but in terms of just my own devotional reading, sometimes this contemporary rendition of passages is hard for me to get by. There's too much of a familiarity to it, I guess.
Now, you used the word rendition. You used the word dynamic. Tell us what that means in terms of biblical translation.
Well, I'm not a scholar of Bible translations, but it seems like somewhere in the 1960s, probably, with primarily Eugene Nida and I think some others who were in his camp, and I can't give you a whole lot of the I can't give you the lay of the land of scholarship here, but about the time that the NIV, the New International Version of the Bible, came out, there seemed to be a pretty decisive split in the translation community. And if it goes back farther than this, then I'm just not aware of it. But where you had a certain stream of translators who followed a more literal word-for-word, or at least an attempt at a word-for-word translation out of the original languages. And anyone who's worked with languages knows that that's strictly impossible. But the attempt was made to stay as close as possible to the original wording of the scriptures. And then there was another stream, if you will, of that river that broke into that is known as a dynamic equivalence. The style or the philosophy of translation is dynamic equivalence. And it was an attempt to render the underlying text more on a thought-for-thought basis. So you would take the phrase or the sentence or the thought, and the translator, if you will, would ask, how is this thought best rendered in contemporary English?
In the language of today,
right.
Today's people would
right.
understand.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay. Let me remind listeners that this is a live call-in show every Sunday afternoon here on WILL AM 580, and we cherish your contributions. Do give us a call. The numbers in Champaign-Urbana, you can get several local lines by punching in 333-9455. And if you're outside the Champaign-Urbana area, do use our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And that includes people who are listening on the Internet, anywhere in the continental U.S. Use that toll-free number, 1-800-222-WILL, or 222-9455. If you have a comment, if you have a question, please join in this informal conversation that I enjoy so much Sundays, but I'm happy to share with others. Our guest again is Norm Hubbard, who is the National Staff Advisor of the local student chapter of the Navigators. Where did that name come from?
It has nautical origins that sometimes come back to bite us in campus ministry because people oftentimes will come up and ask whether the Navigators is a sailing club at the University of
sure.
Illinois. But it actually does have origins in the Navy. So back in the 1930s, the founder of the Navigators was reaching out to sailors in the Navy piers in San Diego, and it was in the pre-World War II era, and as tensions began to build in the lead-up to the war, the Navy wondered, what is this group? You know, these sailors are meeting together in small groups. They wondered if it was some sort of clandestine activity, and so they, in a sense, forced the Navigators to identify themselves, and at that time, it was not an organization, but they declared themselves to be the Navigators, helping people to navigate spiritually, and the name stuck.
We have a caller on line number one. Let's go to that call. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Norm Hubbard. Go ahead, please. Line number one. Are you there? Yes, now I can hear you. Welcome.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
About all these translations, when does dynamic equivalence, or like the message, which isn't really a translation, begin to show the bias of the individual translator, or the bias, their theological bias creeps into the Bible and it gives it another meaning? I mean, is the Bible that Joseph Smith edited the same, or the Miller Bible from the Jehovah's, and all these different Bibles? And then there's the Protestant Bible, which removed many books from Old Testament books from the canon. So all these different Christian groups claim that their Bible is the literal truth and is God talking. And so I would just like for you to comment, how can that be, all these contradictions and all these different interpretations? Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for the call. I do wish the caller, I'm curious just about an example of a specific contradiction, or but to maybe address the question of just the general bias of translators as they work with the text. And I mean, obviously you can, you know, go to a bookstore and pick up various translations. Some of them have pretty distinct meanings given to each of the passages. I think my answer would be, we do have access to the original text from which these translations are derived. Now, there is, of course, scholarly debate about whether these manuscripts that we do have from the ancient world, are they, you know, originally from the pen of John? Are they originally from the pen of Peter? Nonetheless, we do have original manuscripts, and most of the modern translations are not worked out by a single translator. Even Eugene Peterson's The Message, and I think I picked up from the caller that he's probably read that Bible at least in part and doesn't find it particularly to his liking. Even Peterson didn't work on that project alone. He had a board of reviewers that were working with him. And so, yes, there certainly can be theological bias that comes into play, but the underlying text of the Old and New Testaments are available there for any person with a facility in the languages to judge for himself the merits of the translation. And so I think that I won't say that we're entirely immune from bias in translation of any work, but when there is a large body of scholarship that's worked out over the translations, you can certainly compare. You can certainly read the reviews of scholars who are competent in that field and know whether or not a passage was rendered or translated accurately or adequately.
Now, the caller mentioned the differences between Protestant versions of the Bible and Catholic. He didn't mention Orthodox, but he could have.
Sure.
Is the Navigators primarily a Protestant organization, or do you have Catholics who read the Catholic collection of books that's approved by the Vatican? Do you have Orthodox Christians who read what the Patriarch has approved?
In answer to the Orthodox question, one of my good friends from my university days at Auburn University in Alabama actually works with the Navigators and is a part of the Serbian Orthodox Church. And actually his master's work was done in Belgrade, and he has spent the better part of the last 20 years studying Hilandar, one of the most notable, I guess, maybe the holiest place in the Serbian Orthodox Church. It's actually located in Greece, or off an island of Greece. And so, yes, the Navigators as an organization is not specifically a Protestant organization. There are also Catholic students who are involved, not here at the University of Illinois presently, but there are Catholic students involved and there are staff people. There are actual Navigator staff people who are working, who are practicing Catholics and working alongside the Navigators, or alongside the Catholic Church.
Now, you mentioned other chapters of the Navigators on campus. How many are there, other campuses?
Oh, there are chapters on other campuses.
Yes, I understand.
Yeah, okay. So the chapter here is, well, your question, how many other chapters are there? There are probably staff, excuse me, that are working on about 175 university campuses here in the United States.
Wow. And some campuses would have several staff, like this one has two, you and sort of a staff person in training.
Right. I work alongside another staff in training.
Okay. And how many total staff nationally does that, or is it an international organization?
It is an international organization. Okay. There are about 600 university staff that work here in the United States, about 1,700 staff who work with the U.S. Navigators, but then there are also international navigators as well, people who work abroad who are not American nationals.
Okay. Now, another part of that caller's question, and I do thank the caller for that, that question, he asked about whether the way he phrases it, he says many of the groups that use different interpretations all think that theirs is the literal truth and that their translation is God talking. Do you think that's what the Bible is?
If I understand your question, do I think that the Bible is God's direct revelation? Is that a fair way to summarize what you just said?
He used the phrase God talking.
God talking. Yeah. Okay.
Or is it the literal truth, I think he said.
I think that maybe I would prefer, since I used it in my language, I would prefer to say that I do believe that the Hebrew Bible, the New Testament scriptures, are not man's highest reflections on God, but God's revelation to humans through human agency. So he did use people, obviously, to write the scriptures, and I don't think those people were taking dictation from a divine voice. But I do believe that the scriptures of the Old and New Testament represent God's revelation to us.
So much of the Bible, I used in my little poem that we started with the phrase the library, because it's written, you know, over a 1,000-year period by all these different people in different cultures, different languages. And yet you see it unified in that it's all somehow God's revelation, that God was active through that long period and through the various people, not dictation, but I guess how trustworthy is it?
It's a great question. And I like the word that you use. I actually like the way that you were expressing it in your poem, though I can't remember the language. I'm sure you would do better at this. But that there seems to be an overall unity where God is working through history. He's working through people. He's working through circumstances. And as you read it, you see that God seems to be calling people out of the circumstances of hardship that they're in, and it may be calling them out of their difficult circumstances into, I think you used an expression like arid wanderings or something like that. And I like that because I do feel like there is, as you read the scriptures, maybe part of the arguments for its trustworthiness is the overall unity that you do see in, as you read, this vast collection of writings that are worked out over, you know, hundreds, thousands of years, very different circumstances of the people and the writers, that there does seem to be a unity, that it seems to be God, a merciful God who is in pursuit, he's pursuing people with love in order to redeem people, not only from difficult earthly situations, but from the pernicious influence of sin in their lives, in their cultures. And so I do see the unity of that message as even an argument for its trustworthiness.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Norm Hubbard, who is the local campus director of the Navigators, a student organization on the campus of the University of Illinois that deals particularly with understanding the Bible. It's a Christian organization that works with students and others. If you have a question for our guest today, do call us in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Elsewhere, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs, and I ask some questions, but I'm happy to have others do that too. So do give us a call. Norm, when you talk about what the Navigators does, there are a lot of Christian and other religious organizations on most large campuses like the University of Illinois. What distinguishes the Navigators? What's your style? What type of ministry do you have?
Sure. The Navigators was born out of, as I say, in the 1930s, this ministry to sailors. And the distinctive from very early on has continued through today is an emphasis on life mentoring or life-on-life discipleship, where the Navs are not known. The Navs, by the way, is the diminutive form of the name there. Not known for hosting large events. We're not really an event-centered organization, but we are our goal, if you will, is to identify students who are spiritually interested in understanding the Bible or understanding or learning more about Jesus, and then trying to meet them at the place where they are, helping them to take a next step in their spiritual growth through one-to-one mentoring.
We have a caller with a comment or question on line number one. Yes, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm just following up on the comment that the guest made about that there are original manuscripts of the Bible. Did I understand correctly that there are in existence or an actual original manuscript? Thank you.
Yes. In answer to that question, I don't believe that there are any autographs of the scriptures that are in anyone's possession, meaning that we have the original manuscript, for instance, that Paul wrote of the letter that we now know as 2 Timothy. So no, there are no original autographs of the scriptures. Most of them have come down to us in copies of copies of copies.
Now, when you talk about Paul, say, being the original author of 1 and 2 Timothy, does the Navigators accept any of the conclusions of historical and literary criticism of the Bible that would look at some of these books and say, well, this is a very different type of language than Paul, say, wrote in Corinthians, or boy, this is a different theology here than
sure
there is over there.
I will say that the Navigators, as an organization, does not have a position on the question that you just asked. You would find if you interviewed 10 Navigators, you know, week by week, that it's not really a community of academics. Now, I have a pretty strong academic interest myself, but more a community of practitioners. And there would be a variety of opinions probably on the question that you ask. I just finished this semester. We did in our group a fairly in-depth study of the book of Ephesians. And The verdict, if you will, is out and probably always will be from this point forward on who is the original author of the book of Ephesians. It's always historically been accepted that that was from the hand of Paul, but there are other scholars who would hold that it is a representation of Pauline theology, a summary of Pauline theology, perhaps written by someone who had studied under him and was compiled in Ephesus. The Navigators do not take a position on questions like that.
Okay. You mentioned your own academic background. You were in college yourself at Auburn in Alabama. What
yes
did you study there?
I studied English literature during my undergraduate career, and then I got a master's degree in applied linguistics.
What interested you about applied linguistics?
Well, I was, for all of my days at Auburn, I was a volunteer ESL teacher. So I volunteered to help international students develop in their English skills so that they could succeed at the university. And as I ended my undergraduate career, I realized that there was no future for me in studying and writing about literature, but I really enjoyed all of the time that I had spent teaching English to internationals. And so when I went into the field of applied linguistics, it was with a view towards teaching English abroad, hopefully at a university. And that was a very good plan. It just happened not to be the one that I was to walk down.
Where did you make the change in your life to get involved with the Navigators?
Well, I was involved with the Navigators as a student, freshman at Auburn University. My roommate somehow got involved with this organization, and about halfway through my freshman year, I went on a retreat and found myself in company with people who I liked and who I wanted to be like. And so I began, you know, taking part in Bible studies and eventually began meeting together with a student leader and then with a staff person of the Navigators. And so I was involved all through my undergraduate career, got married shortly after graduation. And
before grad school?
Before grad school, actually right in between my undergraduate and grad school. And so married and then TAing through grad school, I didn't have quite as much time to participate in the student ministry, but I did do some stuff. I stayed involved, if you will, almost as a volunteer with the organization at that time. And then for 2 years afterwards, I taught at Auburn University as an instructor in the English program, actually teaching English as a second language, and all the while looking for opportunities to go and teach abroad, which was what I thought I was supposed to be doing. And then, lo and behold, here I am, and that story is probably more interesting to my wife and I than it would be to any of your listeners.
And you and your wife have four children, including one who's very young.
Yeah, we do. We have an 11-year-old named Tom, a 9-year-old daughter named Kayla, a 7-year-old daughter named Rachel, and a 5-month-old named Joseph. So we don't sleep very much.
Now, when you talked about your own experience as an undergraduate at Auburn with the Navigators, it was another student who introduced you to it. You said you went to a retreat. You found people you liked. Is that typically the way people would learn about the Navigators and get involved? You talked about earlier about the one-on-one or the life-on-life discipling. Tell us about that technical term, discipling.
I'm glad you asked that question. It is a technical term, although it has biblical origins, and maybe the biblical origins.
I've heard about the disciples.
The biblical origins are probably more interesting than the more recent cultural phenomenon. Obviously, if you read in the New Testament scriptures, Jesus called disciples to follow him. It was not limited to the 12 apostles. That term was used more generally of people who associated themselves with Jesus to learn from him everything he had to teach. And his final words recorded in Matthew, they were probably arguably not the final words that he ever uttered on earth. But if you read at the last chapter, last verses of the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus gave this commission to his disciples to go into all the world and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to observe everything that he had commanded. And then he promised that he would be with them always. And so not only was Jesus himself calling people to be his disciples, which is really, as I understand, a common Greek term that just meant a learner, someone who would associate himself with a rabbi in order to learn from that rabbi everything that he had to teach. But then Jesus turns around and, upon his departure from earth, commanded his followers, his disciples, to go and do that same thing in all the nations. And so when I use the term discipleship, what I mean by that, and people may mean different things by that, but what I mean, what the Navigators generally mean by that, is helping people to become disciples of Jesus. That is, to learn from Jesus how he would think and feel and respond if he were in their place. Now, the term, this is maybe debatable, and I've never taken the time because I don't have the interest in going to research this, but the term discipleship or making disciples, other than being a biblical concept and a biblical term, was really not used probably until after the 1930s and 40s, when the Navigators began to use that term as sort of a pivotal point of their ministry philosophy. And then because of the association of the Navigators with the Billy Graham evangelistic crusades and the follow-up work that the Navigator-trained volunteers or NAV staff did with the Billy Graham Association, the term discipleship or disciple-making or whatever you want to use, any sort of derivative of that word, became more popular. And so now it's in more prominent use today, probably because of the efforts of the Navigators, or at least the use of that term in the NAV ministry.
Now, there have been some groups that have focused on discipling, as they often call it, that have been very controversial. Some of them have been accused of being very cult-like,
sure,
and use the one-on-one methods to radically change people in ways that may not be for the good.
Absolutely.
May make them non-thinking sort of, gee, I believe you know a lot more than I do. I'm going to do everything you say no matter what it is.
Yeah.
And how do you distinguish your understanding of discipleship, discipling, making disciples, that has that long historical tradition in Christianity from some of these groups that are perhaps quite dangerous?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think that what you find if you look into most of the cult expressions of discipling is that there's generally one figure, generally living, a prophet or someone like that, who takes on a decisive role in issuing divine authoritative decrees for people who are, you know, in his flock or under his care. And the movement in discipleship in that arena is not towards becoming like Jesus Christ, but becoming like the person who is over you, whether that's someone directly over you or whether it's the head of the cult. And so I think one primary distinguishing mark in the question of one-on-one training is a person being trained to understand the scriptures of the Old and New Testament? Are they being encouraged to become like Jesus, or are they being encouraged to become like the person who is training them, if you will, or the person who is over them?
Who might be quite flawed.
Right. And yes, and probably is. And I think the other thing that you notice in the cultic expressions of this sort of one-on-one, what has traditionally been called brainwashing, is that they also would have a different revelation other than the scriptures that have been historically received in the church. And so there's not just a very dominant figure, but there are also other textual authorities that people are being encouraged to embrace and live according to.
We're talking with Norm Hubbard from the Navigators here at the University of Illinois campus. My name is Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs. We're about halfway through. Let me give our phone numbers again so after this little break, people can call and join the conversation. If you're long distance from Champaign-Urbana, 1-800-222-9455. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be having a panel discussion of the Tolstoy book, The Death of Ivan Illich, or Ivan Illich, as I understand it might be better pronounced and closer to Russian. Maybe Norm knows how to do this. And we have four panelists, two Protestants, Tracy Heilman and Mike Mulberry, and a Zen Buddhist, Elihu Smith, and a Jewish rabbi, Norman Klein from Sinai Temple. We're looking forward to that event. It's part of the Big Read Project, with a lot of people in this community reading that small novella by Tolstoy, Leo Tolstoy's great The Death of Ivan Illich. Coming up this week, on the 23rd, Wednesday, there's a medical panel discussion, and Evan Melhado, head of Medical Humanities and Social Science Program in the College of Medicine, will be moderating that panel, and people will be talking about the medical aspects that are part of this book and about death and dying in general. And that's Wednesday, April 23rd, And that will be, let's see, at 5 o'clock in the Medical Sciences Building Auditorium. That's 506 South Matthew in Urbana. That's free, 5 o'clock, Wednesday the 23rd. Discussion, the how and why of dying from a medical perspective. Thursday the 24th, part of the Big Read Project, a Borders Reading Group at 7 p.m. That's at 802 Town Center Boulevard in Champaign, Borders Music, Books, Music, and Cafe. A professor from the Slavic Languages and Literatures will be leading that book discussion, open to everybody. And on Sunday, April 27th, the Urbana Free Library at 2 o'clock, Mary Wilkes Towner will be leading a discussion again. People who would like to come and talk about the book at the Urbana Free Library at 2 o'clock on Green Street in Urbana. That's next Sunday. And also next Sunday is when our program with here on the radio will be discussing a panel discussion of the book. So do pick it up from the library or elsewhere if you haven't read it. Or if you haven't read it recently, it's a wonderful, fascinating book. Well, also coming up this week, Thursday, the 24th of April, here on Focus 580 on WILL, David Inge will be talking with Lawrence Rosen from Princeton on Protecting the Prophet, Understanding Muslim Reactions to the Danish Cartoon Controversy. That's at 10 o'clock here on Focus 580 this week. And just a reminder, our guest from last week here on Keeping the Faith will be live and in person at the Provena Covenant Auditorium, Monday, April 28th at 7 p.m. That's Josh Slocum talking about What You Don't Know Can Cost You, Current Trends in the Funeral Industry. Well, let's get back to our guest, and we have a caller waiting on our toll-free line, line 4. Go ahead, please. You're on the air. Yes, line number 4. Can you hear me? Line number 4, are you there?
I think I was line number 1. I'm not
well,
sure.
Well, no, you go ahead. I hear you now, and so you ask your question or comment, and there's no rush.
Thank you. I'm really enjoying your program. I'm in my car traveling towards Dayton, Ohio, but I have a question. I've been a Christian for quite a while now. I'm in my 60s. I have a 25-year-old son, and he definitely believes in a higher power. He was educated in a Christian school growing up. But in our family, my husband is very honest, very ethical, and has had a lot of trouble in his career. Right now we're waiting on an answer. He's applied for a job, and for the last 3 weeks we've been on a roller coaster. And just that's a little background, but I had quite a discussion with our son the other night because he's just questioning, where is God in all of this? With dying children, mistreated children, my husband waiting for a job, if God is so kind and loving, where is he? And I tried to explain to him that we can't see the whole picture. Our life here is very short. We have the gift of living with him forever and eternity, and things aren't always what we think they should be here. I don't believe he totally believed me, but I'm just wondering if I'm off base or what more I could say to him.
Well, thank you for that very good question, and we'll let you get back to driving and let you listen on your radio. Thanks a lot for the call.
Said everything I need to say. I appreciate your answer. Thank you.
Great. Thanks a lot. And how do you relate the problems of this life that so many people have, death, dying, suffering, loss of jobs, with a merciful, good God?
Sure. Well, I think the answer that you gave to your son is a very good answer, that we do have a very limited perspective on the ways of God. And so for us to, I guess, if you will, judge the justice of God or the mercy of God on the basis of a limited perspective worked out over a limited range of circumstances is probably not the safest route to go in trying to understand the character or ways of God. So I think that the advice or the counsel that you gave is very good. I think that if I were, and I'm all of us who have lived any length of time have had to deal with the question of pain, the problem of pain, as well as the problem of suffering and evil that is perpetrated by the wrong choices of other people. And I do not have an easy answer to those very difficult questions. I think if I were in the position where a friend or a student in our ministry were asking me that question, what I would invite them to do would be to go and read the teachings of Jesus, because neither you nor I nor anyone else could claim to be an authority on those matters. But it does seem that Jesus had a perspective that was not limited as ours was. And so I would recommend opening up and reading one of the Gospels. And I don't have a particular passage in mind, but just to begin to allow Jesus to speak into that very complex issue the way that he did when he was walking on earth.
We're talking with Norm Hubbard of the Navigators, a group on the University of Illinois campus that particularly is interested in understanding the Christian Bible. You mentioned the teachings of Jesus. There are some Bibles that have the words of Jesus printed in red, and there are some Christians, particularly recently, who have been focusing on those words of Jesus. They often call themselves red-letter Christians because they're very interested in trying to follow the teachings of Jesus. Is that different than what the Navigators do?
Steve, I don't know that I know any red-letter Christians, so I'm not exactly sure if I can answer that question. I certainly have seen and probably own one or two Bibles with Jesus' teachings in red. My guess is, no, that's not quite what the Navigators are trying to do. Because if you follow, well, let me just take that. If you follow the teachings in red, if you follow the words that Jesus spoke, he very clearly believed in the authority and the sufficiency of the Hebrew Bible. And so if you're going to confess that Jesus is Lord, then you'll also have to confess that he had an understanding of the Hebrew Bible, that it was God's revelation, and that it is sufficient in answering questions of doctrine and practice. You would also have to accept his teaching in John 16, that there was more that he wanted to teach his own disciples, but he said that they were not ready for it. And so in order to make them ready to receive the more that he had to teach, he promised that he would send the Holy Spirit, who would illuminate them and reveal to them things that he would have otherwise taught them had they been prepared. And so that sets you up for the writings that follow the Gospels, the writings after the red letters in the black letters in the epistles that follow. So Jesus both believed in and relied on the authority of the Hebrew Bible, and he also instructed us that we should expect revelation to come from the Holy Spirit to the apostles who would write later on the things that they weren't prepared to receive while Jesus was on earth. So in answer, direct answer to your questions, the Navigators would teach people to understand the Bible as a unity in its whole and not simply focus exclusive attention on the words of Jesus.
Let's go back for a moment to your personal history. You were telling us about your study at Auburn in English literature and then in teaching English as a second language and so forth, applied linguistics. Did you have a specialty? Did you take all sorts of courses? Did you ever take courses in the Department of Religion in, say, Introduction to the Bible or New Testament or Hebrew Bible or whatever?
The only religion course that I took, because I didn't have an interest vocationally in working in the field of religion, ironically enough, was a course in the Old Testament, which was it was an introductory course. It was probably a 100 or 200 level course in the Old Testament. A visiting professor who taught it, I cannot remember his name. He was a young fellow, wonderful teacher, a wonderful course. I remember one paper that I wrote in that course on the names of God in the Old Testament, and it was very, very good for me in my understanding. But no, I focused most of my research on language acquisition, primarily second language acquisition, especially into grad school. I mean, I took a variety of literature courses coming through. And then my thesis work was actually over, it was a project that no master's student should have ever tried, and I was burned because of it in lengthening out the thesis for quite a while, but it was over a Nigerian folklorist. It was somewhat of a post-colonial literary analysis.
But you did finish.
I did finish. Thank you. Right. Yeah.
So since that time, have you done any systematic study of the Bible? Do you have any favorite teachers, any favorite books?
Yeah, I have no formal training in religion, so I have never pursued, although I've wanted to pursue, but just have not had the liberty to pursue any further religious training. Favorite authors, I love G.K. Chesterton is probably my favorite author in the world. I love the writings of C.S. Lewis. For contemporary writers, I read and appreciate Dallas Willard, a professor of philosophy at University of Southern California. Jerry Bridges is actually a navigator, staff person, and author who has been very influential in my life. His writings have been, as well as in our organization. So those are a few. I read very broadly. I love to read. In fact, I was a Russian studies minor, so I read a lot of Russian literature in my day.
So you know Tolstoy. Without this sort of academic study, do you feel that's the best way to approach the Bible, to sort of read it and try to figure out what it means inductively?
I think that's a good way to read and understand the Bible, though not the only way, and probably not sufficient in itself. So I mentioned that in a small group Bible study that we had, we were studying the book of Ephesians, and one of the things that we asked people to do was to take the book of Ephesians, divided roughly into paragraphs of about 5 or 6 verses, and reflect on the things that they were reading without the aid of outside scholarship. So simply to read and attempt to understand, so to make observations on the paragraph that they were reading, to think through any correlating passages, either in the book of Ephesians or outside of it in the Bible, that related to the paragraph under study, and then to think through the implications or ask questions and propose answers to try to interpret the observations that they had made from the paragraph. So I do believe that that is a very good initial step of beginning to study and understand the Bible. But, you know, you're talking about 18 to 22-year-olds reading the Bible alongside of, you know, me, and I have no formal training. And so I believe that we ought to be reading as part of a larger conversation with scholars whose lives are devoted to studying this. Yeah.
Well, let me ask about something you quoted earlier.
Okay.
When you quoted the last few words of the Gospel of Matthew.
Right.
One of the words mentioned in there, go and make disciples, but was baptism. Now, baptism in the Christian church, there's this huge divide. Mm-hmm. Probably most of the Christians throughout history have baptized infants. Since the Protestant Reformation, there's a lot of Protestants, not all, but some Protestants who say, oh, no, you should only baptize people who consciously make a decision for
right.
Christ to be Christian. Which is right? And how do you decide? Here it is in the Bible. It's important.
Sure.
You think it might even have been Jesus' last command, but how do you do it?
I have not. I will tell you that, you know, I have certainly, because I think we all have to at least make some decision who are trying to read and understand the Bible and apply it to life. You have to at least tentatively come to some conclusion on that question. I will say again, the navigators have very consciously avoided taking a position on that. And so there are people who practice infant baptism. There are people who practice what is traditionally known as believer's baptism. That is, someone is only baptized as an adult when they've made a conscious profession of faith in Jesus. And so the answer to the question of how do we decide which is right or which is true, I think you go to the scholars who study it, read, try to weigh their handling of Scripture and come to a reasonable conclusion on your own based on the study that you've done. That's not a very decisive answer, I realize, but...
Well, let me push a little bit on that, Norm.
Please.
That's a very Protestant answer. You decide as an individual.
Sure.
You consult with others, but you make the decision. Now, there's this great stream within Christianity represented by the Catholic Church, most notably.
Sure.
And since the Pope is visiting right now, we would be particularly mindful of it, that would say it's not an individual decision and it shouldn't be. The whole tradition of the Church will interpret this and tell you what's correct according to what's been handed down from the time of the apostles. How do you, as a Protestant Christian and in an organization that tries to be open to Catholics and Orthodox who would have more of that understanding, how do you deal with that just practically?
I'm not sure that I've ever had to deal with that particular issue in a practical sense of like a student comes to me and says, well, should I believe the teachings of the Church, meaning the Catholic Church, or you know, do I think about this and can I arrive at a position different from my own faith tradition? If that question were posed to me, I would encourage a student to open the Scriptures, read, study, think, and go back to his priest or her priest or whoever it is, you know, teacher that they respect within their faith tradition and say, here are some of the conclusions that I've reached on the basis of my own study, but I realize many Protestants have a peculiarly individualistic approach to reading and understanding the Bible. Even in the time of the Reformation, there was never allowance for a person simply to cut loose, go out and read the Bible, and you know whatever interpretation they came back with was deemed to be true for them. Even the Reformers believed that there was a community of faith, there was a community or a fellowship of believers, and there was safety in numbers, if you will, even in interpreting the Scripture. And so I think that a person ought to employ all of their faculties of understanding and avail themselves of all the research that they can, but to work that out not only individually, but also in community with other people who are seeking to do the same thing.
We're down to the last 4 or 5 minutes of this program. I've saved one of the most difficult questions for the last.
Great.
What about other religions? Christianity is today and has always been, as far as I can tell, a minority religion. The Navigators focus on outreach, on spreading the news of Christianity. What do you do when you encounter someone who is spreading the news of Islam or of Buddhism? Do you try to convert them? Do you recognize them as a good Muslim or a good Jew? And, of course, we remember our Jewish friends who are celebrating Pesach, Passover, this weekend and on. How do you respond to other people of other faiths?
Generally, I ask them to dinner or coffee. Some of my first contacts with people in the religious community here at the University of Illinois are in the Intercultural Friendship Foundation, a Muslim student group here on campus that promotes interfaith dialogue. And I think that the best first step to make in conversation with anyone, whether they're of a different faith of your own or of no particular faith, is to establish something of a friendship, if possible, and then to talk. For me, you may want to ask a follow-up question to this, but when I meet an observant Jewish person or a devout Muslim, is my first move to try to convert them to Christianity? The answer is no, because I don't understand. I know nothing about them, and that seems to be a very not human way to approach relationship or friendship.
Do you worry in those kind of settings that they might have an ulterior motive to convert you in having a dinner with you?
I would expect that a devout Muslim would want me to become also a devout Muslim, because my understanding is that they feel like they have an understanding of the path of salvation that was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad. And I would expect, especially as a friendship grew, that they would want me to come to understand salvation from the perspective that they've received, and yes, that they would want to convert me. Now, if their faith didn't promote or teach conversion or didn't believe that other people needed to understand and embrace these teachings to be saved, then no, I wouldn't expect that. But for a person who believes that they have found the way to salvation, to withhold that from me would probably be a mark that they were not particularly interested in my friendship over the long haul. I mean, it would be withholding from me something that a friend would actually share.
And so people who call that proselytizing, you feel, really don't understand the basic good motive.
Well, yes, and proselytizing in itself is a neutral term, but it's used in a pejorative sense so much of the time now. But yes, I think there is proselytizing that's done that I think is pretty dehumanizing. I mean, it's an attempt for me to tell you what I feel is important to tell you in spite of whether you want to listen to it or not. It's not particularly effective, and it can be particularly offensive. But no, I do believe that the general impulse of proselytization or evangelization, as it's used in the Christian sense, is or ought to be done from a good motive of wanting to share what in the New Testament is known as the good news with a person whose soul you care for, with whose friendship you value.
I want to thank our guest today, Norm Hubbard, who is the National Staff Advisor of the local student chapter of the Navigators, a Christian outreach group here at the University of Illinois. Thank our callers for their good questions. If you missed part of this program, you can find it archived online in a week or so at will.illinois.edu. Go to AM and then look for Keeping the Faith, and you'll find all of our past programs there, going back several years, and you can hear parts that you missed or look at others in our archives. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program, and I'm the director of the University YMCA, where coming up this spring is our annual dump and run collection of items, particularly furniture, that people maybe are tired of or moving out and don't have room to take away. Would simply like to donate to the University Y. We collect these, save them over the summer, and have a grand sale in the fall in the Stock Pavilion with hundreds of international students arriving and many other students who are trying to furnish apartments and rooms. Get great bargains. We make a little money for the Y that helps our programs and keeps a lot of stuff out of the trash stream. So if you'd like to participate, starting May 5 through 9, Monday through Friday, we'll be collecting at the Y and in many large square cardboard collection boxes around campus. If you like to bring things to the Y, do it between 8 and 5, Monday through Friday, Saturday mornings, also May 12 through 16, also May 19 to 23. That's coming up, collection for Dump and Run. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Next time on the Afternoon Magazine, our monthly program on computers. Our guest this month will be Greg Klein. He's on the Science and Technology beat at the News Gazette. He'll join us at 1:06. I'm Celeste Quinn. Please join me Monday through Friday for the Afternoon Magazine. The program begins at noon with news from NPR, the BBC, and AM 580. Here on AM 580, WILL Urbana, and online at will.illinois.edu.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Billy Baruz, Champaign; Inuka Incorporated, Fairmount; Illini Studio, Champaign; Risk Management Commodities, Lafayette; and Remax Realty Associates, Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life with a very exciting announcement. Normally, when we take our show on the road, we can only do shows in 5 or 6 cities. Well, we're going to be doing a live show, and this time we are going to literally hundreds of cities at the same time. How, you ask? How can we do such a thing? Well, we're going to do one show and send it out live via satellite into movie theaters all across the country, including a theater near you. Thursday night, May 1st.